must honestly acknowledge the circumstances we inherited.
The U.S. economy has shown great improvement.
We have the worst financial recovery in 65 years.
The ongoing expansion has been the slowest since World War II.
94 million Americans are out of the labor force.
The economy has greater scope to create jobs without generating too much inflation.
We must restart the engine of the American economy.
There is a great deal of uncertainty about just what policy changes will be put into effect.
We must create a level playing field for American companies and our workers.
We should simply be patient and wait to see what happens.
My job is not to represent the world. My job is to represent the United States of America.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Well, it's been another good week for investors with some rip-roaring rallies in the markets this week. Talk about that 300-point jump in the market. And then, of course, we had some good economic numbers coming out, and the president gives his first address to Congress and the nation. All of that setting stocks on fire this week. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Up in Hour 1, Ralph Ancampora will be joining us, and it's real interesting as Ralph and I talk about the stock market. He believes we are in a long-term secular bull market in stocks. And I begin my conversation with Ralph with a comment he made in last September in terms of things that he was watching. He was predicting that this market was ready to take off. Boy, did he catch that one right. You're going to want to hear what he has to say. Ralph Ancampora will be joining me in Hour 1. Also, Kurt Wolf will be talking about the energy sector. We're going to talk about this disparity that we're seeing right now between the price of crude oil, which is up in the mid-50s, but the energy stocks have been languishing. In fact, one of the year's worst performers compared to last year when they turned out to be one of the best performers. He'll be joining me in Hour 1 along with Ryan Poplava on what moved the markets this week.
And I'm John Loeffler. Last week we discussed on The Big Picture seven megatrends for the next decade. Among others, the retail ice age, automation and the death of jobs, the new migration around the country to various parts that hadn't been central in economics before, energy, education, longevity, and Orwell's world, the tendency of governments now to track everything that we're doing. This week we are going to discuss the investment implications of these megatrends. That's the first part of The Big Picture. And, you know, it's beginning to look like there's some kind of a change in the Fed's policies about raising interest rates. For a couple of years there, you remember, we were going, are they going to do it or are they not going to do it? And most of the time they didn't. But in December, the Fed raised interest rates for the second time. They've changed their forecast for 2017 to 3 rate hikes. And it looks like, even though people thought they'd wait until June, it looks like 3 rate hikes are a possibility starting this month. And so we'll look at see how the markets are reacting to that and some evidences for it. All of that coming up today on The Big Picture right here on the Financial Sense News Hour. And over to Ryan Poplava. It was, I guess it was an entertaining week in the United States where I think President Trump spoke and looked presidential and the market responded with glee on Wednesday. More of the same promises of tax reform, a $1 trillion infrastructure plan, a call to repeal and then replace the Affordable Care Act. I don't think they're talking about dropping people that have already are depending on Obamacare. It's reforming it and then moving them forward. And the building of the Great Wall of America. Promises we already heard when he was on the campaign trail, but investors continue to reward Trump with their bullish bets to the tune of 33 points in the S&P 500. And of course, with the man no longer on a platform making promises, but rather in the Oval Office, it does carry a little more weight. So this week we listened to the speech and we saw the reaction in the stocks. Anything else going on then in the world of finance?
Yeah, John, Trump's speech was, I would definitely say, the primary catalyst. And going back to that February 9th announcement that he said we would have a phenomenal tax reform, you know, something in front of Congress soon, you know, that's where really things kind of took off for stocks. We've added almost, 100 points on the S&P 500. But there were other undertones that I think will be helpful to add some color on just what's going on besides Trump tweets and Trump promises. One of the items I saw discussed on a few sites, including our own from an article that Chris Sheridan shared, is this growing spread between soft economic data and hard data. And we got a big slew of economic reports this week.
Yeah, and soft data is information on things that are very, very difficult to measure, like feelings or opinions. And not only is it difficult to measure, it changes quite frequently. The ISM and PMI data are surveys. Hard data is information like numbers or facts, which you can actually measure and then prove.
Right. So last week, jobless claims fell about 19,000 down to 223,000. That's a hard number. We can survey those numbers. Actually, survey is not probably the best description, but those are hard numbers. We can look at the results, look at the data, and say this is factual rather than an opinion. And that's the lowest we've seen this reading since 1973. But looking at the ISM Manufacturing Index, which also came out this week, I think on Wednesday, that's a survey conducted across 400 purchasing managers nationwide in 20 different industries. And it takes positive responses and I think a half point towards same responses in five different categories, like new orders, production, supplier deliveries, employment, and inventories. So it's a survey. It's considered soft data, but many economists I read call these surveys forward-looking and evidence of economic activity before it's actually measured in the hard data. Well, right now, John, as Chris wrote on our site this week, there's a pretty big spread between the forward-looking soft data and the hard data we're receiving. There needs to be some sort of reality check where the hard data needs to start catching up to all the soft data, which is very positive right now, off the charts, with all the manufacturing surveys. The non-manufacturing survey came out this week as well. Consumer sentiment, you know, these are all different sources of soft data that have been very bullish. There just needs to be this reality check. The numbers need to show in the hard numbers. They need to match up. We need to see that spread narrow. So either the soft numbers need to come down, maybe they're too rosy, or, you know, the hard numbers, they need to catch up on the upside.
Okay, well, what are some examples of this going on now?
Well, let's look at some of the data points this week and see how they match up with some of the hard data points this week. And I'll try to compare apples to apples. That's hard, but consumer confidence, let's look at that. There was an index that rose about 3.2 points in February. That's the highest since 2007. So consumer confidence continues to rise right with the market, right with conditions. And respondents showed that 13% plan to buy a car soon. 47% said they plan to buy appliances soon, and 48% around planning a vacation trip. So those are some big percentages. Now, looking at the personal income and spending report, that also came out. That's hard data. That's factual. This is not a survey. It's not opinion. There was a 0.3% decline in goods spending. And there was also a 0.2% decline in spending on services, while overall the spending was up in other areas. For a total, the spending report was showing a growth of 0.3% when you factor out food and gas. So that's where, you know, 47% say they're buying appliances. Well, here we're showing that there's actually a decline in goods spending. Now, looking at the mortgage application survey, it showed that the purchase index was up about 5.1%. While looking at hard data, construction spending actually saw a drop of 1%. And that was actually below. There was a consensus expectation we would see a rise of 0.6%. So that's kind of cherry picking a couple of the reports that came out this week, but just going to show you the difference between hard and soft data. But if you look at Chris Sheridan's article on our website, financialsense.com, it was called "The Spread Between Hard Data and Soft Data at 17-Year High." There's a chart there, which I think he pulled from another blogger, showing Bloomberg Surprise Index for soft and Bloomberg Surprise Index for hard data. And that really sums it all up. There's a huge spread where the soft data is way above the hard data. And earnings and economic soft data are moving higher. I've been talking about that for a long time, since before the election. And of course, looking at an underwhelming GDP forecast of what we're looking at for Q1, given some of the research reports I'm reading, you know, that hard data is just not coming in yet. Dare I say it's coming in soft. It's an interesting development, John. It definitely needs to see that spread narrow. And it's definitely, like I said, it's starting to catch a little bit of wind here. And this is the kind of stuff you start to hear when you've got a PE ratio on the market up near 18, the market's extended. You're going to start to hear some reasons of why maybe some portfolio managers don't have their clients as fully invested right now as before, or maybe some are even shorting the market. You know, you're going to hear reasons of what's negative. What's negative out there? And we're definitely hearing it now in the spread between soft and hard data points.
Okay, well, we'll have to watch those hard data points over the next month or so and see if the soft data is leading the market higher on false pretenses or not. So, you know, that's going to be something that has to play out. We do have an FOMC meeting coming in a couple of weeks. Janet Yellen gave a speech about the timeline from adding accommodation to scaling it back on Friday, although she seemed to indicate that they were going to continue poking these rates higher. Did she shift, do you think, the narrative at all for the Fed, or is it autopilot for rates? I mean, because you said last week that every meeting is a live meeting where rates can go up, and we have a meeting coming up in 2 weeks. So what do you think the sentiment is on all of this?
I don't think Janet did anything to change the view right now. Dudley did. William talked about, I think it was right after the market closed on Tuesday, he said that the case for an interest rate hike has become a lot more compelling. Use those words. And we definitely saw the expectation. We got some good economic reports this week as well. The market heading up. You know, there's a lot of things or areas that the market looks at. The spending report, the PCE deflator, or the price index. Looking at what's going on there in inflation, that's very much, I think we're at 2%. I think we're right on target. So expectations are pretty high right now. We'll get a rate increase in March. You know, looking at the Fed futures, they're pricing in an 82% chance, last I checked on Friday. The only piece we're missing now is the February jobs report next Friday. If that report is copacetic, you know, we're likely to see a rate hike probably at this live March meeting. And Janet didn't really change the paradigm on that on Friday. She was just giving kind of like a history lesson, showing us where we came from, why accommodation was here, given the reasons in 2013, 14, and 15. And then as we were scaling out, why? And then looking at the balance sheet, you know, what their plans are with scaling back on maybe some of their purchases down the road. Once we have a little bit better GDP numbers, maybe better growth, more solid, and no more, obviously, hiccups going on overseas, no Brexit talk, that's going to really be disconcerting to investors. But investors in general are comfortable with the gradual approach. And remember the last FOMC plot for rates, which was at the last conference meeting in December, had projected, a majority had shown that they expected rates to go up around 3 times this year. And it seems we're on that course. So when it comes to rates and being behind the curve, is the Fed behind the curve? No, they don't think so. They think they're removing accommodation at a gradual pace. They think they're on track. But I'm actually more concerned about Europe. You know, if you look at their CPI report for February, it was right at 2%. And that's mainly due to energy. With the core rate, the growth wasn't as serious there. It was just 0.9% growth. But still, if that CPI figure stays or maybe even continues to build, you'll have an accommodative ECB policy that, in my opinion, will be maybe running a little hot. So next week, the focus in the markets will be on China's economic forecasts. We'll start to get an idea where they're forecasting now for the GDP and other figures. The ECB will be meeting, so we'll look at what kind of policies they'll be talking about. One of the biggest catalysts for us as a firm when we were investing a couple of years ago was looking at the divergence in policy between the ECB being extremely accommodative and the Fed removing it, and what that did to the dollar. And what happens to the dollar and what that does to trade, what that does to commodity prices. So if the ECB is going to continue to kind of stay way behind the curve here on removing accommodation, as they maybe still feel like they're in a crisis situation, I don't think they can build that case now. I think that'll be an important discussion this year, is how is the ECB going to, are they going to catch up to the Fed? what are they going to do to begin removing? How behind the curve are they? That's a big question for me. But also next week, U.S. jobs report. That'll be on Friday. Following that, in 2 weeks, John, there will be an FOMC meeting. As you mentioned, the debt ceiling is supposed to be reinstated. We could go another 3 months, probably based on Treasury movements or, you know, their balance sheet plans. I have no idea. But finally, there's Trump's budget should be submitted to Congress by the 16th. And, you know, the markets will want to see if it's phenomenal, as Trump put it just a couple of weeks ago.
We'll look forward to it, as we always do. As we've said for some time, it's going to be an interesting year all around. So I appreciate the report. And Lord willing, we'll see you next week.
Sounds good, John. We'll definitely talk about the ECB China and that ECB meeting.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
In case you didn't know it, the Financial Sense NewsHour is more than just our weekend show. We also have a weekday program featuring key economic experts, which is only available to our premium members. Here's part of one of the interviews from this last week.
Now, we know that when the Fed raises interest rates, that usually comes at the expense of two things. You usually expose the bubbles or the excesses of the day. And this time around, it's not housing, and it's probably more related to commercial real estate or subprime auto loans. But at the same time, we know that the Fed, even the Fed that moves in this most ginger fashion, they tend to overdo it in both directions. They overdid it in 2007 with a 5.25% funds rate at the peak. And this time around, the peak will be a lot lower. But once again, the risk is that the Fed overdoes it again. We've had 13 Fed rate hiking cycles in the post-World War II era. I've got news for everybody. Out of those 13, the Fed landed the economy in recession 10 times. We had the beloved and fabled soft landing 3 times, but the soft landings happened in the 3rd year of the expansion, not the 8th. And actually, that to me is the thing that people are not talking about, is that the Fed has already gone on record as saying that they are not going to accommodate the fiscal stimulus. They're raising rates no matter what. They will go even more if they adjust their GDP forecast higher in light of whatever fiscal plan we get out of Congress in the months ahead.
Well, the Trump rally continues on Wall Street. It's hard to believe that the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up over 3,000 points. One of the biggest rallies we've seen for a president in probably decades. Joining us from Altera Investments is Ralph Ancampora. Ralph, I want to go back to something that you said last September of last year. And you said, you've been looking at charts for 50 years, and I've never seen this. And you were talking back then that we could see a very strong move in the market. Tell our listeners, what were you seeing in the charts that alerted to you in terms of what we're now seeing unfold in the market?
Well, Jim, if you take a look at the Dow or the S&P 500, you'll see that for a couple of years, it's been in a very, very narrow range, all throughout 2015 and 16. And what I was referring to then, it was a very technical term, the Bollinger Bands. If anyone is familiar with them, you'll note whenever they tighten up, get very, very close. In other words, trading range gets even tighter. The odds are that you're going to have a very sharp move either up or down. And my forecast was up because I saw the quality of the leadership under the surface. And in hindsight, I'd rather be lucky than right.
Ralph, as we look at what we've seen transpire in the Dow, I can remember watching on election eve where one of the anchors was saying something's going on. And at one point, I think the Dow futures were down 800 points. And here we are taking a look at Dow over 21,000. Did you expect to see a move as explosive as this? And number two, have we ever seen this kind of rally with the president taking office?
Well, actually, I was on TV right after that. And I referred to the sharp sell-off. And if you'll notice that day, it had the sharp sell-off overnight. I think it was around 800 points or something. And then when it turned intraday, it started turning up. And that's when I was on TV. And I said, this could be the shakeout and set the stage for something that would be very, very impressive. And I referred to it as a rebirth of capitalism. And I referred to the breaking of the regulation chains. And I think that's exactly what's happening, Jim. Wall Street's getting this breath of fresh air, and this administration is just feeding right into the animal spirits.
Yeah, and the day you and I are speaking, right after the president's address to Congress, at this moment, we've got the Dow Industrials up 280 points, over 21,000. Ralph, another good thing that I've seen, at least, you're seeing widespread participation. Comment on that when you start to see a lot of the sectors participate.
Yeah, that's basically been throughout most of this move here. We technicians call it the breadth of the market. When you have more and more participation across the board, I mean, if you look at the 10 S&P sectors, except for a couple of them that lagged a little bit, they're starting to catch up again. And I'd say right now it's about 90-95% participation on the upside. And that's very, very encouraging.
So when you see all the major indexes and all the major sector groups participating, that tells you that this bull market has a lot of strength to it. I guess you would call that
a fully in gear market. Everything's going.
Yeah, everything's going. I want to talk about two sectors. You know, some of the sectors have been lagging. One thing I've been noticing, if you take a look at, we've got the price of gold, which has been moving up. You've got the price of oil, which has been moving up. But Ralph, the oil stocks and the gold stocks have been moving in opposite direction. Does that tell you anything?
I think on a very short-term basis, I think the weakness in, let's say, Exxon and Chevron, I can't justify that in the face of the fact that the oil actually has been holding up fairly well. But I think that weakness is probably near its end, and I think energy stocks will start to play a game of catch-up. I'd say the same for gold. Gold right now should back off a little bit as the market heats up. I just want to say one thing. I like to go back to the Reagan period, because I was there 36 years ago, and we in Wall Street were just in love with the new president, just like what we're seeing right now. And Reagan's honeymoon lasted 6 months. Trump is in his fifth month of his honeymoon. If we had any time-wise, I'd say maybe Donald has another month or so. I'll give him two more months. And maybe this honeymoon will be a little long in the tooth, and especially as the market starts to accelerate here. We're going to get a little ahead of ourselves. I'm not saying today, but if we continue at this pace, I think even Reagan had the end of his honeymoon, and there was a severe sell-off. By the way, that sell-off ended in August of 1982, and that was the beginning, that bottom in the August 1982 was the beginning of the next secular bull market that lasted 18 years. So long-term, you look across the valley, Trump and what he's proposing bodes very, very well longer-term.
So in the short-term, when you have an explosive rally like this, we know nothing goes straight up, so we could have a pullback here. Let me talk about something else that we're seeing here. After the election, we saw bond yields rise and stock prices rise at the same time. Now, since recently, bond yields have pulled back somewhat, but we have a Fed that is in a rate-raising cycle, and I saw today that the futures market is pricing an 80% probability of a hike in March. Does any of this concern you in the short term as a problem for the market?
Again, let's get back to this honeymoon period. If we accelerate, as we're doing right now, I call it you get into nose blood territory. Because charts are starting to spike up on a 90-degree angle. I get a little nervous with that, okay? And if we get any kind of a rate hike, I think that would be the catalyst for the correction. So in one way, it could end the honeymoon, and that would be justifiable cause for the correction. But longer term, if you look at the financials, oh, my heavens, they bode so very, very well with the rising rates. And you can see it being manifest right now, right across the board, whether it's banks, insurance companies, et cetera.
Yeah, that's one thing I think a lot of investors are forgetting. Rising rates, if you're a bank, the higher or steeper the yield curve, you make the difference on the spread. So the higher that curve is, the more money that can flow into the financial sector, which has been one of the problems that have plagued this sector over the last couple of years. So this could be positive in that sense. But also, Ralph, what about also lending and credit? In other words, if banks have the incentive now, because the yield curve is steepened, to make more loans, that should also be good for the economy.
Absolutely. That's why I think what we're planting are the seeds for a very, very long-term positive recovery. I want to make another observation, though. If interest rates go up, which I totally believe they will, especially if you look at over the next 10, 15 years or so, guess what? Mrs. O'Brien's going to look at her monthly statements, because she still has lots of bonds, and she's going to start seeing losses in her bond prices, because as rates go up, you know bond prices go down. And that money that's been sitting on the sidelines in the hands of the public is going to come back into equities. So that's more fuel later on for the continuation of this, I call it a secular bull market.
You know, technicians will sometimes tell you about there's three phases or up phases in a bull market. The last phase, usually the public comes on board. And one of the things that we've seen, Ralph, in this bull market, it's been driven by a lot of stock buybacks, corporations, $500 billion of stock buybacks per year. You've had central banks buying. Individual investors have been largely parked in cash in bond funds. So we've got the market up a couple 100% since the bottom of 2009. At what point do you think that's the final phase of the market, when Mrs. Smith looks at her monthly statement and says, oh my God, I'm really losing money in my bonds here? Is that where we get the capitulation phase, kind of like what we saw from 1995 to, let's say, 2000, when the public just went full bore into the market?
Yes, that's what you'll see. But I don't think the elements are in place for that yet, because rates have to go out a lot higher, and she has to really start seeing those paper losses, well, the real losses, in her bond funds. I think that's down the road a piece. But on a very short-term basis, what we're seeing now is accelerated prices, and you could get a blow-off right here, and call it the Trump blow-off. So, you know, I've had an outstanding target for the Dow of 22,000. We just crossed 21,000 today. It looks like we're going to hit 22,000 very, very quickly. I have to go somewhat to push it a little bit higher on the Dow. So I'm starting to see that we're getting a little lofty. I'm not throwing in the towel yet on this rally, but you know what? Keep looking at the sentiment indicators, the weekly bull bear numbers. When they start getting up to around 75%, then there's your excessive optimism.
You know, one of the things that we've seen, and I've seen this very rare, at least in my career, where you had stock yields or dividend yields on stocks higher than bonds. That's come back somewhat as bond yields have head up on 10-year treasuries. But Ralph, you can look at the Dow stocks, especially the dogs of the Dow, and look at several stocks, high quality companies that have dividend yields over 3%, in some cases 4%.
Absolutely. And that's why smart investors have been in this market for a long, long time. My wife, God bless her, was a stockbroker for many, many years, and she did it with all of her clients, just locked them into these high yields. And now, with the market doing what they're doing, they're very happy, you know, and they should be.
You know, that's something I think that we lost perspective. I know in the bull market of the 90s, everything was on growth. But I want to talk about secular versus cyclical, because we saw that the S&P peaked in March of 2000. It peaked again in September of 2007. And I think it was April or March of 2013 before the S&P would actually take out its all-time highs and head to new record levels. So that was a 13-year stretch of time where the market virtually went nowhere. Do you consider, when you look at this market from a long-term perspective, that we are in a secular bull market versus, let's say, a cyclical bull market?
Yes. A 50-year career on Wall Street, I've seen two secular bull markets. First one started in August of 1982. That was Ronald Reagan's low, his second year in office. And that lasted 18 years. Okay, and it peaked that you're talking about January 2000 for the Dow. And for the next 6-7 years, especially the crash in 07, 08, 09, that bottom in March of 09, I considered that the generational low. I consider that March 2009, the beginning of this secular bull market. And if history is repeat, we've got at least a decade or more left.
Given where we've seen stocks rise, and you've got a short-term target here of roughly about 22,000 on the Dow, if you were talking to a group of investors, let's say a lot of people have sat out this rally, what would you be doing here? Would you be putting some money to work selectively, or do you think at this point, with this 3,000-point run-up, you might want to maybe keep some cash in spare and wait for a correction to buy some stocks?
That's an awesome question. It depends on the audience. If they're aggressive and smart enough, or at least disciplined enough to put close stops and get out when the market turns against them, I'd say you could play this market. You could participate in this market. You could chase some of the bank stocks. You could chase some of the technology stocks like advanced micro devices and things like that. They look good, okay, short term. I was meeting and talking to an audience, very conservative, near retirement or something, or even not even near retirement, in their 30s or 40s, I'd say, if you're longer term, if you wanted to participate, I'd only nibble at this time. I'd take small positions in big names like Bank of America and things like that, and then wait for a correction to add to the position.
Ralph, what about the idea of looking at dividends too? Because the one thing I've always liked about dividend stocks, number one, you're getting paid to wait. Because if you're investing in a stock that has no dividend, you're counting on the stock is going to grow along with the market. But if it doesn't, you could experience losses. The nice thing about a dividend, especially if they raise them each year, you're getting paid to wait. In many cases, you're making more than what you could in the bond market.
Absolutely. And the first place to look is in the Dow itself. Take a look at things like Merck and Pfizer, which really haven't really, they participated, but not really that well in this market. I think you're not chasing those stocks. They got a nice dividend while you're waiting. Perfect analogy.
So in the sectors that we've seen, just about everything has been going up, but we've had some laggards in materials. We've had some laggards in energy. You think that could correct itself in the short term?
I think they've been correcting. I think energy's, it could be a little early on this, but I think energy's probably nearer at a bottom. I'm talking about the big energy stocks. Just keep your eye on the price of crude. You get above $44, $45 a barrel. That'd be a huge upside breakout in the price of crude. And I think that stimulates buying interest in these large blue chip energy stocks.
Final question, if I may. If there was one thing that would worry you about the markets, what would it be?
Sentiment right now. I was just a couple of weeks ago at the Money Show in Orlando, Florida. I was speaking there. The place was hugely crowded. I asked the lady that was running the show, I said, how's the crowd? She says, oh my gosh, this is almost record crowd. That makes me a little nervous. The animal spirits are out and the public is really looking and sniffing around. It's fun and it's exciting, but be careful. I think in the next few weeks, we could blow this thing off to the upside.
Very good advice. Well, listen, Ralph, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow your work, how could they do so, please?
Well, I'm on Twitter. I put out a couple of tweets. I'm not as prolific as the president, but I do have a couple of comments.
Okay. Well, listen, Ralph, as always, we appreciate you coming on the program. All the best to you and your family, and come back and talk to us again.
Thanks, Jim. Take care.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com.
If you're approaching retirement age or concerned about making plans for those retired years and having adequate income, you're going to want to hear our Lifetime Income series every Monday and Tuesday here at financialsense.com. Right now, here's a preview of this week's Lifetime Income program.
There's a lot of great facilities these days, and life is pretty darn good inside those facilities, but it's also pretty darn expensive. But 80% of long-term care claims that insurance companies process usually start off with home care. There's a lot of great facilities, but nobody's racing into a facility if they could be at home. You mentioned $3,800 is probably a good expectation to start for receiving home care here in San Diego, and I would say it could only go up from there. I have interacted with people and provided insurance to people who many years later needed to be in facilities. And here in San Diego, and it's not even exclusive to San Diego, I have people who pay, you know, $10,000 or $12,000 a month to be in a facility.
Well, since reaching a low in December of $42 a barrel, oil prices have climbed up to $54 a barrel. They've been going sideways for the last month, but the energy stocks have been lagging the price of the commodity. Joining us on the program is Kurt Wolf from McDepp.com. And Kurt, I'd like to get your take on what you think is happening with energy stocks, because since the beginning of the year, they haven't really done much. They've been heading south, while the price of crude has been heading north. What do you think accounts for that difference?
Well, I think the price of crude is holding up well. That's reassuring. It's not going a lot higher on a short-term basis. And there still are pretty substantial inventories out there that are coming down slowly. I think we're waiting for a little more response on the demand side so that the supply and demand can match up again. We have quite a bit of extra inventory that we need to work down. And it's being worked down, but maybe not as fast as some people might have thought. And we don't know what the future brings, but I'm a high price guy. I think we're still heading higher. We're resting for a while on oil price. My long-term oil prices are around $70 a barrel. You know, we can be surprised at any time on the way towards $70. I'd be even more surprised, though, if we went lower from the current level. So I think the upside outweighs the downside. And on the demand side, I think it does relate to economic activity, as it always does. And we're optimistic that we can get a program of less regulation and lower taxes and better economic growth growing here.
Kurt, what about the situation where you have oil rigs are going up since the beginning of the year? I think they're up several hundred rigs now since reaching a low. And also oil production is increasing, especially shale production. Do you think that would be a limit in terms of a cap on the upside of oil? In other words, let's call OPEC the floor on oil and let's call shale oil the cap.
Oh, yeah, no doubt that it is a limiting factor on the upside. And I think that's been evident for several years. So I'm not talking about $90 or $100 oil. I'm talking about $70. So I think there's some upside left yet, but not much beyond that unless we have some kind of unusual circumstances. But that's a close call. You know, there are a few companies that can produce shale oil at a profitable level at lower prices. Not everybody can. So I think for the industry as a whole, we're going to get a good response, but ideally not so much that it impacts the price level more than we already expect, which is a limited upside. But a $70 upside still is a very good business for these companies.
Do you think this disparity that we're seeing now between the price of the commodity and the price of the stocks reflects this sort of uncertainty? Maybe the investors are waiting for oil prices to sustain themselves? Because what happens, Kurt, in 6 months when these cuts are supposed to stop? The stuff I'm reading is saying that in order to keep prices where they're at, OPEC is going to have to extend those price cuts into the second half of the year.
Yeah, that may be. We'll have to see about that. My sense is that we had a nice recovery in the last year. I'm very happy about how well the stocks did in 2016. We were one of the best performing groups last year, so this year we're not going to perform at a high level right away, but I think the outlook for later in the year is still good. So I remain positive on oil and gas stock.
You know, it's interesting as you've seen these technological developments occur in the energy industry, whether it was fracking, horizontal drilling. I just read a story last week, maybe you saw it in the Wall Street Journal, where Exxon is using computers to map a well reservoir. And I think in the story, the journal talked about they use the equivalent, Kurt, of 22,000 computers to map out a well reservoir, which allows a company like Exxon to get a better understanding of the reservoir, but also get more oil out of the ground.
Yeah, no doubt. The oil companies have made great use of technology. They may not be called the high-tech companies, but they're one of the industries that uses the most of the high-tech stuff. Exxon is an interesting case, though. Of course, they've always been a technology leader and have smart people and usually know what's going on. They don't necessarily react as quickly as the independents do. And it really was the risk-taking by the independents that developed a lot of the shale oil and shale gas potential. But Exxon is still a very solid company. They had their meeting with analysts last week. I was there. I don't know if I have any new enthusiasm for Exxon, but it's one of the stocks, and I view it as an anchor in the oil portfolio.
In looking at the industry itself, I mean, I remember when shale was first out and the price of oil fell from over $100 all the way down to the $20 level in that range. There was talk that a lot of these companies couldn't make money, but then you saw technology develop and a lot more companies, whether it was EOG or others, are saying, you know what, at $40 oil, we can make some money. At $50 oil, we are making money.
Yeah, that was quite impressive. And, you know, the Permian Basin probably gets some credit for that because there are so many different formations in the Permian. If one doesn't work, maybe another one works. And it's always been a huge repository of oil. It's quite exciting to see how the technology keeps improving.
So as you look at this industry, I guess one question, you followed the large cap stocks, the mid cap stocks, and some of the smaller tiered stocks. How many companies can really actually increase their top line through unit production? I know the shale companies are capable of doing that, but what about, you know, as you get to the large companies, the Exxons, the Chevrons, it just doesn't seem to me they're going to be able to increase unit production unless they go out and buy somebody.
Well, you got a couple thoughts there. On one hand, they tend to be very secure companies. Their goal is to increase their dividend They're more on a value category than a growth category. Nonetheless, you got to keep trying to grow just for the sake of keeping up with what you're doing. And it tends to be the case. I've been covering these companies for a long time, and there aren't many small companies that I knew 30 or 40 years ago that are still small companies today. Something usually happens to them, and in the end, they tend to be part of a bigger company. So it's a long, well-established trend that the large integrated companies sometimes acquire the innovation and the opportunities from smaller companies. Now, we haven't seen too much of that, although we're seeing some. You know, Exxon just, well, there were a couple unusual deals this year. EOG bought Yates Production, which was a very well-regarded private company, been private forever. This was kind of like a once-in-a-lifetime chance for them to make that acquisition. And Exxon bought the properties from the Bass Brothers, the Sid Richardson heirs, and those have been family properties from the beginning of the oil industry, practically. So that was sort of a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, too. So there have been a couple of those traditional acquisitions. Some of them are waiting a long time to be acquired to pick the right time. Otherwise, we haven't seen as much acquisition of companies as we might expect. There's been a very active property market, and private equity companies have been very active in backing people, putting together new companies. So there have been a lot of transactions, not as many as historically of whole companies.
Yeah, well, it's been interesting with these lower prices. You would have thought that a lot more acquisitions would have been taking place with bigger companies buying mid-tiered companies buying smaller companies. But a lot of this has been done in the private equity realm, where you have private equity raising capital for this and basically buying specific properties rather than the companies themselves. For example, you just mentioned buying the Richardson properties for Exxon. So it's been a little bit different market playing out than most people expected it to turn out.
Right. If I did have to name one possibility, it's the same one you and I have talked about before. It sure looks like Cimarex would be a great fit for Chevron because they're operating a lot of Chevron's properties in the Permian Basin. But whether that happens or not remains to be seen. It's hard to put the odds on one particular deal.
So as you look at the energy field right now, we've got valuations at low levels. We got the price, which is more than doubled since hitting a low last year. If you were looking at this marketplace, where do you see the best values in terms of your MCDEP ratios, whether you're looking at large cap, mid cap, small cap? Where lies the best values in this kind of market?
Yeah, starting with the big companies, I actually have my buy recommendations on Royal Dutch and Total, the European companies, which, you know, the European stock market's been lagging behind the U.S. market. Actually, Royal Dutch has been a pretty exciting company lately now that they're digesting their acquisition of BG Group. But most investors in the U.S. like to buy U.S. companies. So for the big guys, it's a choice between Exxon and Chevron. And Chevron has performed well in the stock market the past 6 or 8 weeks. And Exxon has performed very poorly the past 6 or 8 weeks. They're now at a point where Exxon is actually maybe slightly cheaper or about the same value as Chevron, and it's traditionally been at a premium to Chevron. They're both good companies, but I think there's probably an opportunity right now in Exxon to snap back a little bit from its underperformance in the past 6 weeks or so. Both Exxon and Chevron are nice long-term dividend growers. So if you like a little bit of large cap income investors usually are interested in Exxon and a Chevron. And moving down the list, the large cap production companies, I have ConocoPhillips and Marathon as being a little cheaper than the others, and their value is good in ConocoPhillips and Marathon. At the same time, EOG has really been the better performer over the long period of time. They've actually grown their value on a relative basis more than the other companies. But they don't show up as being quite as cheap as those. So my approach would be you put more of your money in the ConocoPhillips, for example, but you also have a little bit of EOG as well. And if you go down to the real small company, that's where we've really lost a lot of money the last couple of years. And they still have further to come back. Continental Resources is a high-quality company. It's actually not quite as cheap as it used to be, but it's one of my recommendations. You know, the best company in that small cap group is Cimarex, but it's like EOG, its MCDEP ratio is not quite as low, so I'd own a little bit of that, but I would put a little more in Continental Resources. Put some money as well in Range Resources. Range is depressed. It's a natural gas company, a big natural gas company with huge resources, but natural gas has been more volatile than oil, and right now it's at a run up, it's a run down. Now we have some warm weather, maybe today it's a little cold here in New England. it's quite price sensitive. So when I do my projections on Range Resources, they change quite a bit with gas price, but the resources in Range Resources are practically unlimited. They're the people that discovered the Marcellus Shale, and they bought Memorial production in Louisiana, which has all that attractive gas down there, close to the LNG plants. Anyway, Range Resources is a natural gas play, and every other stock I mentioned so far is primarily an oil play. I have my royalty trust group, Dorchester Minerals, just reported yesterday. Good report. Sabine Royalty, high-quality company. Then I have the Canadian stocks. In Canada, we have this little company, Birchcliff, great growth record. But probably the easiest pick in Canada for a conservative investor might be Suncor. Suncor's stock is concentrated exclusively on oil. They don't have any gas. A lot of heavy oil. Heavy oil really got hit this past year, both in a discount through the light oil price on a crude oil basis. And then there was the fires in Canada that knocked out production for practically 3 months. So they're coming off of a tough period there, and it's a very sound company. It pays a reasonable dividend.
I want to move on to another issue that was of concern when we saw the price of oil drop is, would the majors be able to maintain their dividend? And a lot of the companies said that was a priority. You saw them cut back on expenditures, whether it was delaying projects or laying off employees. And you also have some companies that are shrinking, whether it's British Petroleum or you have Shell, that are liquidating assets that are less productive. The one nice thing that came out of this is that these companies were able to maintain their dividend. In fact, in some cases, like Exxon, they actually increased it a bit, which was surprising. So how do companies, you know, when you have companies that shrink, as you're seeing right now with Royal Dutch or even British Petroleum, how do they grow again in the future?
There's a big difference among these companies. Certainly Exxon and Chevron, in my view, never were threatened. So the fact that some people thought that Chevron was threatened and that Exxon's AAA credit rating was actually even slightly lowered by one of the rating agencies. That I thought that was unnecessary, but then you never know. You know, prices did go down. I was also confident in Exxon and Chevron, and they are increasing the dividend. They have had a record of 30 or 40 years of increasing dividends, and they want to keep that going. And they maybe in Chevron's case, they did on a very nominal basis. But there's no problem with the dividends. They're growing, I think, in those two stocks. Now, the European companies are a different case. They pay higher dividends to start with. They have more debt. So there was some risk, I thought, that Royal Dutch would cut its dividend. But the management, in this case, really took a strong stand and said the dividend is not going to be cut. The dividend is sacrosanct, or whatever words they use. Unfortunately, they've lived up to that, and I don't think we're going to see a growth in the Royal Dutch dividend for a while, but the cash flow has been coming back very fast. They're getting volume growth in Brazil with that BG Group acquisition, and BG was big in the LNG. LNG was looking a little soft in the summertime with all new capacity coming on, and summertime prices were weak. But then when the weather got a little cold in Asia and Europe, the LNG prices firmed up, and the LNG business got a lot better, and that's one of the long-term pluses, I think, for the majors is liquefied natural gas. That's a growth area. Well, natural gas is growing faster than oil and LNG. Liquefied natural gas is still a very small percentage of the natural gas market, and it has all this flexibility. You can ship it to any country in the world. And the number of countries receiving LNG last year, you know, doubled or tripled from the previous year. So that's a fast-growing fuel. And Exxon, Chevron, Royal Dutch, and Total are all well established in that business. I don't cover BP. That's why I'm not saying much about BP.
Okay. Well, Kurt, a final question. If there was a dark cloud on the horizon or something that could throw your forecast for higher prices on oil, let's say your $70 target, what would that be?
I guess it's some kind of disaster striking. We have a war. We have a cyber attack. But those are hopefully the very low probability events. On something on a higher probability event, you'd have to have slower economic growth. Maybe some kind of breakdown in the producing discipline. But Saudi Arabia seems to be pretty firm on their views right now. We can always be surprised. We weren't surprised that oil could go as low as it was. It was very low. But the timing is always a surprise. Anything can happen. But we think that under normal circumstances, $50 is an easy price for consumers to absorb. It's the price that keeps the companies in business. And if we get some growth from here, the price can strengthen.
Well, listen, Kurt, as we close, if our listeners would like to read and find out more about the work that you do, tell them how they could do so, please.
They can access my website, mcdepp.com. No password, no money required. You could just tap into it and see all of my research for the past 15 years that I put up on a delayed basis. My clients get it first, but a few weeks later, it's up for everybody.
A couple of years ago, we did a show on megatrends, large trends that we believe would reshape the next decade. What we're going to do today on The Big Picture is an update on what we consider to be the seven megatrends of the next 10 years. Some are the same and some are different, but either way, they will affect our lives. And also, the next market crash, passive versus active investing. Every bull market has its own characteristics. So what are the characteristics of this bull market and how long before it rolls over? All of that coming up next on The Big Picture as the Financial Sense News Hour continues at financialsense.com.